Ladies and gentlemen, I have the great honor to welcome one of the most distinguished US military leaders and security experts, H.R. McMaster. Welcome to Weltwoche Daily, Lieutenant General.
Boris, hey, it's a real pleasure to be with you. Vielen Dank.
With pleasure. Before we dive into current world affairs, let me introduce you with the words of the best-selling author and professor, Peter Bergen. Peter Bergen said about you, H.R. McMaster is the smartest and most capable military officer of his generation. One who has not only led American victories on the battlefield, but also holds a PhD in history. Now, General McMaster, you are both an accomplished doer and a deep thinker. You are a West Point graduate, retired United States Lieutenant General, and you served as the 25th United States National Security Advisor to President Trump. And you are a longtime friend of our magazine. I remember catching you on the telephone during breaks of Operation Iraqi Freedom almost 20 years ago, and you kindly granted us highly valuable insight into your counterinsurgency missions. Now, it's great to have you back, and let me suggest to focus on the hotspot of the moment, Iran. When US President Trump waged war against Iran, the Iranian regime, I should say, he kicked the hornet's nest. Since February 28th, the Iranians swarm out and sting its neighbors wherever they can. What is it that surprised you most in terms of the Iranian reaction?
Boris, I have to tell you, nothing surprised me. And the way I think about it is that President Trump didn't start this war. This is the latest campaign in a war that the Iranian regime started against, the great Satan, is how they refer to the United States, Israel, who they call the cancerous boil, and their Arab neighbors in 1979, beginning with the taking of U.S. hostages. And there's been the whole litany of aggression against the United States in what has been really a sustained effort by the Iranian regime to kick the United States out of the Middle East and extend hegemonic influence in the region, surround Israel, destroy Israel, and kill all the Jews. I mean, that's really been their obsession since 1979. It's part of the ideology of this regime. And so I see this campaign in context of that, that 47-year-long war that Iran has been waging against the United States, Israel, and its Arab neighbors.
Now, in retrospect, the siege on the Strait of Hormuz seems to be, the logical, most effective reaction Iran would try to achieve. Nevertheless, it seems that President Trump didn't fully see that coming. I mean, at least that's the impression you get watching from the distance. Would you say he has underestimated the consequences of the war?
Or I really don't think so. I mean, I can't imagine. And this has been what's been reported, of course, that he was surprised by this. But in our military, we conduct an annual exercise, Horace, about the closure of the Straits of Hormuz. It involves up to 30 nations every single year. And so this was what I think was the most likely response by the Iranian regime. Now, it was believed that, hey, the Iranian regime would not close the strait unless there was an existential threat to it. Well, clearly, with that initial strike against Iranian leadership that began this latest campaign in this 47-year-long war, it became existential for them. So remember, it was not only the closing of the strait, but they fired drones and missiles at 14 neighboring countries. 14. And so I think if there was a surprise, maybe the surprise is that they went after even the Gulf states who had been aiding and abetting them for years, including the Qataris and to a certain extent, even the Emiratis, who did a lot of the banking for the Iranian regime. So, if ever there was a doubt about the nature of the Iranian threat, not just the United States and Israel, but also their Arab neighbors, all those doubts were removed. Now, they should have been removed a long time ago because Iran had been applying the Hezbollah model to multiple countries in the region. That's where they, like in Lebanon, they build a militia outside of the government's control, Hezbollah in this case, that can be turned against a weak government if that government acts against Iranian interests. They've done this with the so-called Hashdashabi militias in Iraq. They've done this in Yemen with the Houthis. And of course, they enabled the Assad regime to, in its serial episodes of mass homicide in the Syrian civil war. And so Iran has been really sponsoring these civil wars against their neighbors in the region as a way to keep the Arab world perpetually weak so they could extend this sort of land bridge to the Mediterranean, build a ring of fire around Israel. And of course, they lit that ring of fire on October 7th, 2023.
What I find remarkable in the many reactions this war caused is just recently that the United Arab Emirates now welcomed Israeli soldiers and their defense systems, like, the Iron Dome and others. And they're actually operating on the territory of the United Arab Emirates. It has never existed before. This is a total first. Did that surprise you in some way, or is it just a logical consequence of the Abraham Accords that were signed in 2020?
I think it's a logical consequence of recognizing that the region's security depends on really defeating Iran and defeating the Islamic Republic of Iran's ability to project power outside of its borders. Because now everybody's in the same, the same situation as Israel in terms of the threat from Iran's drone and missile strike complex, this sort of conventional wall they were building behind which they could then pursue a nuclear weapon and even longer range missiles. So I think there's just a recognition in the re an inescapable recognition after all of them have been attacked that they have to work together. Now, they were actually working together, quite well in intelligence and in sharing technologies even before this, but it hasn't been out in the open that much. And so now I think what you're going to see is a coalescing of this sort of Gulf security apparatus and infrastructure. This is really what the United States has been pursuing along with Gulf states, since the 1970s. You saw it in play during the direct attacks against Israel by Iran in April and October of 2024. You saw that defensive network activated across really all the Gulf states working, kind of behind the scenes, but shooting down these missiles and shooting down these drones. I think you're going to see this as a full spectrum kind of maybe not explicit defensive coalition, but I think that's what you're going to see emerge out of this war is collective security in the Gulf that includes the Israelis and many of the Arab states.
Now, what's remarkable and very typical, one can say, is that President Trump keeps everybody guessing with his next moves. Some call him the master of chess, but I would call him the master of guess or guessing. And what is interesting to see there is somehow he seems to make spontaneous decisions. Now, you were his national security advisor. How much does he listen to, or did he listen to you and his closest advisors? And how, what can you say how he makes decisions?
Or, this was 2017 to 2018. And in my, I have a book about this called At War with Ourselves. And in it, I describe how we struggled against kind of, I would say, the president's natural impulse toward, thinking out loud and making a series of incremental decisions by presenting him, first of all, with with the objectives, the goals to confirm, hey, is this what you're trying to achieve? And then once he did that, we would bring him options and have structured conversations. He learns through conversation about these particular options. And behind those options were very well-developed plans that would integrate all elements of U.S. national power and efforts of our allies and partners internationally. I think that's what's missing, Oris. What happened is somebody convinced President Trump as he came in to the second term that his own staff, that's the National Security Council staff, the National Economic Council staff, was the so-called deep state. Those who create all this bureaucratic inertia that was preventing him from making faster progress on his agenda. That wasn't the case, really. Your own staff is what can help drive your agenda. So this structured decision-making, I think, is really what's missing. And that's why you see such, I think, counterproductive behavior. You know, I mean, it shouldn't come as a surprise, you know, if you insult your allies and then ask them for help afterwards, that they might be a little bit reluctant to give you the help. So I think a lot of what you've seen in terms of, I would call it, you know, self-defeating behavior comes from that lack of decision-making structure, that lack of discipline in decision-making. And of course, once decisions are made, you need that kind of staff to integrate the implementation of those decisions, to align what you're doing diplomatically with what you've chosen to do militarily, to have really strong and consistent communications. And what I think has been most disappointing about the course of this war is the degree to which there have been these inconsistent, unserious at times, and bombastic kind of communications that undermines international support for which everybody should be behind. I mean, the Iranian regime has conducted, you know, about 120, I think is the number, assassinations in Europe, you know, and so I think this is the largest sponsor of transnational terrorism in the world, you know, and also Iran has helped to create the refugee crisis that's affected Europe, affected European politics, with essentially, you know, especially the Syrian civil war and their role in the mass murders and the refugee crisis. So, you know, I regret that the president isn't taking advantage of the potential of having a more structured decision-making, policy-making process, you know, to make the decision, but also for implementation.
Now, what I always highly admired in your career is, and what earned you a reputation as a highly respected, innovative officer, is that you successfully fought the Iraqi insurgency both in South Baghdad and in Tal Afar. And what was important, that's what you told me at the time, you know, it's important to read the enemy's mind. Now, if we're trying to read the minds of the elites of the Revolutionary Guard who seem to be in charge in Iran these days, what do we need to know about how they think and function in order to kind of understand their next moves?
Well, I think the first thing to understand is that these are people who are permanently hostile to the United States, again, the great Satan, Israel, their Arab neighbors, and the West broadly. So until there is a change in the fundamental nature of that government, there's not going to be peace for the people of the region, and there's not going to be security for the Iranian people. The second thing is that the aspirations and attitudes of this regime are not compatible, not consistent with the aspirations and the attitudes of the vast majority of Iranians. There's that gap there. And therefore, they rely on repressive apparatus to maintain power. This is the Basij, right? These people who come out and beat people into submission have committed the mass murder, we think, of 40,000 people in a 48-hour period in January. And of course, the IRGC. The other thing to know about them is that they're desperate. They're desperate to maintain their grip on power, in part because they control the whole economy. They can, and they've enriched themselves. Mushtaba, if he's still alive, you know, in his bunker somewhere, you know, he has tens of millions of dollars offshore, in banks. So is Golubov. Golubov, you know, the so-called Speaker of the Parliament, is one of the most corrupt people in Iran. And they sit atop of these bunyads or collectives that control the economy. They don't want to give that up. And by the way, they all realize now, after they've committed the mass murder of so many people, the 40,000 people or so in January, the Iranian people are not going to be kind to them if they give up power. And so they're desperate to maintain their grip on power. We should know that about them. They're driven by the ideology of the revolution. They're permanently hostile, and they're out of step with their own population. Once you understand that, then you can kind of see some of the outlines of, you know, what are the prospects for peace? Well, as I mentioned, I don't think there's any prospect for peace until there's a fundamental change in the nature of that regime. And it also should make you realize that the best approach is to drive a wedge further between the Iranian people and the government, to distinguish quite clearly in your actions and in your rhetoric, in your language, that this is not a war against the Iranian people. This is a war that could free the Iranian people from this repressive regime that under which they have suffered for so long. And if you remember, since 2016, 2017, there have been massive annual protests against this regime, all of which have been brutally put down.
What is the path ahead, though? I mean, this seems to be extremely difficult to break that regime, even though it's small in numbers compared to the plus 90 million population of Iran. What is the path to break that regime in order for the people to take over and hopefully establish a more friendly government?
Or so I think it's going to have to be a continuation of this campaign in combination. This is the military campaign to continue to reduce the Iranian state's ability to project power outside of its borders. This might be forcing open the Strait of Hormuz. I think that's really what's going to have to happen. I believe that the U.S. military, especially if joined by a broader coalition, can certainly do that at an acceptable cost, but not without risk and cost, certainly. And then I think continued attacks against the repressive arms of the regime, combined, I think, then with the economic pressure. I mean, Oris, I know it's affecting, obviously people around the world, the interruption of shipping in the Strait of Hormuz, but now the Iranian regime is losing about $450 million a day in oil exports. And by the way, it's running out of capacity for storage of its oil. I mean, it's putting oil like in teacups, probably, at this moment.
Which
And that
would
could
mean
be
that the oil wells would eventually be damaged.
absolutely. So, what do these authoritarian regimes need? As the historian and scholar Stephen Kotkin, the scholar of Stalin, has noted, they need five things to stay in power. They need cash flow, they need security forces, they need control over life chances, the economy. Is coercive control over people because they know they have to sign up to support the regime. They need stories to tell their people, right? Hey, it's a Zionist crusader conspiracy to come after us. And then finally, they need some kind of an international system to sustain them. I think the next phase of the campaign should be to fully isolate the regime from these sources of strength and support, cut off the cash flow, weaken the security forces. Also, I think strengthen the population with all sorts of support, but then isolate them from international support. I mean, China is keeping them on life support, right, with purchases of energy, but also providing them with a lot of the precursor chemicals and so forth that they need for solid rocket fuel, electronic components. We know that Russia is shipping drone components right now across the Caspian Sea to help them deepen their arsenal for drones and so forth. So I think work on them from the outside in, and look at Iran in context of this broader competition with what I would call an axis of aggressors, which includes the two revanchist powers on the Eurasian landmass of China and Russia. This is why the outcome of the war with Iran is directly related to European security. Remember, it was the Iranians who provided the Shahed drones to the Russians for their onslaught against the Ukrainian people. So I think we have to recognize that now's the time, and I hope President Trump sees this as well, to strengthen transatlantic relations, to strengthen relations across the free world, and recognize that this is a consequential competition. Because you know what? If the Iranian regime is finished, say if we could envision that happening, and there is a regime in place that better reflects the attitudes of their people, the aspirations of their people, what happens to Russian influence in the Middle East? It goes to zero. What happens to Chinese influence in the Middle East? It goes to zero. And you know what? The United States and others wind up with the keys to China's gas station, which I think might be critical to preventing these crises that we've seen, these wars in Europe and the Middle East from cascading further into the Indo-Pacific region.
If we focus briefly on the Ukraine war, you just mentioned it. There is an impact, of course. Some people say, it's good for Putin. He can sell more oil, cheaper oil, gas. Others say, he's gonna suffer from this. What is remarkable, I think, is a quote by the Finland's president, Alexander Stubb. He said, after Ukrainian drones have hit targets nearly 1,000 miles from the Ukrainian border into Russia, he said that the tide is turning in favor of Ukraine. And he added, we need Ukraine more than Ukraine needs us meaning the Europeans. Is now, would you agree with that? Does Kiev now offer the world weapons that work and has now an advantage, battle-proofed? Is that something that you would agree that the tide is turning, or is that a little bit exaggerated?
I think the tide is turning, but what we need to help that tide turn with more pressure on Russia, which, as Stubb mentioned, who's a very insightful person, Russia's under tremendous economic pressure. Putin has destroyed his economy. You have inflation, well over 20%. You have a stagnant economy. He's sitting on piles of cash that he can't convert. And significantly, he has a labor shortage, because they've taken over 1 million, seriously wounded and killed in this war, and they're sustaining casualties, some days up to 1,500 killed and wounded a day, for these meager gains as they're trying to take control of all the Donbas. So I think now's the time for more pressure on Russia, financial pressure, economic pressure, and especially, or sustained support for Ukraine. It's a great thing that the barrier is now removed in the form of Hungary's leader, former leader Orban, to provide the financial support for the EU that Ukraine needs. And now I think what we need is a sustained flow of munitions. What you see with Ukraine is unbelievable valor, heroism, combined with astounding innovation. As you mentioned, these longer range drone capabilities, but also Ukrainians are providing expertise to the Gulf states, the Arab states, with the counter drone capabilities. And they've sent teams, to the Emiratis, to the Kuwaitis, to the Qataris, to the Saudis. So yes, they are a net benefit to European security, and in large measure because, they've also, I think, devastated the Russian army. The Russian conventional army is in a terrible state, and they've weakened it to the point. Remember, we have to remember the Wagner Group offensive toward Moscow. I mean, this is an ex hot dog salesman, put together a mercenary group and marched on Moscow, and it revealed the weakness of Russia outside of that very specific Ukrainian theater. So Russia is in a weak position because of Ukraine, and I think we should see them as a security provider, really, for Europe.
A word about NATO. Where does this stand, the Transatlantic Alliance, today? Because we read every day lots of stories about the breakup, the transatlantic breakup. There were insults. People are, insulted. They feel insulted in Europe about some remarks that President Trump made. Now he's announced that he wants to withdraw 5,000 US troops. You were stationed in Bamberg, Germany, I think, in the early 90s. What does that mean, that withdrawal? Is it substantial or is it more symbolic? Where is the transatlantic coalition heading?
I think it is substantial and regrettable, because I think what we've learned after the two devastating world wars of the 20th century is that security that came from strong alliances and forward-positioned U.S. forces as part of those alliances has worked, has prevented great power conflict for 80 years. So why abandon that now? And I think the withdrawal of those troops, this is the 2nd Cavalry Regiment, in Vilseck, Germany, withdraws troops who are positioned next to a great training area where they can keep a very high degree of readiness, and they can respond to any kind of threats in Europe with a U.S. force on the ground immediately, which I think it has a very, very important deterrent value, but also bolsters the ability of the NATO to fight together, and. And so I am worried about it. I think that we have to understand that a lot of Americans feel kind of aggrieved, right? Aggrieved by the lack of burden sharing in Europe after the Cold War. Remember, I mean, gosh, Europe was about 17% of the world's GDP and about 50% of the world's social spending. So American taxpayers looked at that and saw the US covering defense bills in Europe and thereby underwriting European social programs. That was the real, the real anger that President Trump tapped into and voiced. But he won this. This is what I want to say to him. Hey, Europe is increasing its defense spending. Europe is sharing more and more of the defense burden. And by the way, if you look at how the war in Ukraine has revealed the lack of capacity in our defense industrial base, the fragility of supply chains, many of which are controlled by China, a hostile authoritarian power, we have a lot of work to do together. We need everybody to work together, I think, to strengthen our security. But Urs, I'm confident that we're going to get past this. I really do. You mentioned the insults. They were significant. I mean, I fought alongside European soldiers for many, many years, and I was deeply grateful for the sacrifices and the risks they were taking alongside us after the United States was attacked on September 11, 2001. So when President Trump says, "Oh, they weren't there for us," yes, Europeans were there for us. And when he combines that with, I think, which this, he says things out loud, he says things, to be a provocateur, but they have real impact when he threatens to invade Greenland, which is sovereign territory of Denmark. And by the way, Denmark took more casualties per capita than any European country in Afghanistan, where they fought, they had a very tough fight with their battle group in Helmand Province. So hey, I'm not trying to brush this under the carpet, Urs. It's a real problem. It's much easier to destroy trust than to build it back. But I feel confident because, hey, the threats aren't going away from the axis of aggressors, from China and Russia. And Urs, and I don't mean to sound arrogant by this, I don't think there's a substitute for U.S. leadership, because who's going to lead Europe without the United States? I mean, I don't think, I think the United States can be that glue that helps keep the whole family together. Otherwise, there will be subregions that are pretty, pretty tight and cohesive, like I would say the Nordic states, the Baltic states, and Poland. But there will be others who will be skeptical about maybe German leadership or French leadership or fill in the blank, right? So I think the nuclear umbrella, the additional capabilities, strategic logistics and transportation capabilities, communications, intelligence, missile defense. I mean, all of that. Can you imagine the U.S. unplugging that? It would weaken all of us. And I think in the United States, we underappreciate some of the less tangible benefits of the alliance, such as overflight and basing and response times associated with that. So if we were to replicate what NATO has in the U.S., that doesn't make any sense. By the way, it's a heck of a lot cheaper to keep those 5,000 troops in Vilseck, Germany, than to move them to, I don't know, Fort Benning, Georgia, wherever they're going to go. So I think if American leadership just explains to the American people, better the benefits of NATO, people of our generation, or as we're kind of, we believe it, right? Because we grew up in this era. I think we have to explain to the younger generation the benefit of the alliance and begin to rebuild this trust, which I believe we can do. I actually, Urs, I think we're the cusp of winning, if you want to call it Cold War II, because of the weakness of this axis of aggressors. If we could just strengthen ourselves and prove that Vladimir Putin's wrong. Vladimir Putin thinks that Europe and the United States, that we are weak, decadent, and divided. We should act to prove him wrong.
Our time is almost up. Very grateful for what you've given us, and I know you're in high demand. But let me just ask one last question. If we zoom out and look at the warfare, the involvement of, or almost the revolution of warfare, you were a highly effective tank officer fighting in the Gulf War in the early 90s. Now we see a completely new battlefield, with drones evolving in lightning speed. We have just witnessed a precision war. 13,000 targets were hit. There was relatively small collateral damage. What is the most remarkable change in war strategy since your days in the Gulf War 35 years ago? What would you say?
Whereas what I would say is there have been tremendous changes, but also continuities, which is why much of the fighting in Ukraine looks like World War I as well. And so really what you're seeing is the increased transparency of the battlefield associated with drones, manned aircraft, but especially low Earth orbit, combined with the ability for big data analytics now associated with artificial intelligence re related technologies, compute power and algorithms that can provide a high degree of situational understanding, combined with this long-range precision strike. So what this means for the future is that the first phase of the next war will be a phase designed to blind and deceive the enemy and thereby restore freedom of movement and action for military forces across all domains. And that's going to include, low Earth orbit warfare in space. It's going to include cyber warfare, electromagnetic warfare. So I think that's what we're learning, is that the next fight will be to ensure that the enemy cannot see everything within the depth of the area of operations.
Wonderful. Thank you so much for your time. And I wish you a great week that just started now. So, for you.
Lars, thank you so much. Pleasure to be with you.